Good morning and welcome to Behind the Headlines, the Friday morning news roundup from the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW, heard around the state on Utah Public Radio. I'm Roger McDonough. Today on the show, travelers arriving in Utah will now have to fill out coronavirus health questionnaires. Utah lawmakers consider clamping down on local stay-at-home orders. And half of nursing homes in Utah, in communication with the state, say they have had a COVID-19 case. And I have three guests joining me by phone today for this conversation. Salt Lake Tribune reporter Nate Carlisle is on the line. Good morning and welcome to you, Nate.
Good morning, Roger.
Thanks for being here. Also, Salt Lake Tribune reporter Lee Davidson is with us. Good morning and welcome to you, Lee.
Good Friday morning.
Good Friday morning as well to you. And reporter Bethany Rogers, good morning and thanks to you for being here.
Thanks for having me.
And as ever, listeners, you are invited to join this conversation. You can call 801-355-8255. That's 801-355-TALK. And for your with your questions and comments, or you can tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. So we are up to nearly 2,000 cases of COVID-19 in Utah. The health department says about 5% of tests are coming back positive, which is relatively low compared to other states. They think this is because of social distancing measures that we've taken and continue to take. Some of those measures are by choice on the advice of health experts. Some, though, are directives. And that's where I want to start today, actually. Bethany Rogers, you reported that state lawmakers are considering stepping in front of local health orders. Can you tell us where that idea is coming from?
Yeah, so lawmakers told me this week that they had some concerns about just the differences from one county to another in how they're approaching some of these orders and stay-home restrictions. So, for example, Senate President Stuart Adams told me that he worries, say, if someone lives in Salt Lake County where there is a stay-home order but works in Utah County, which doesn't have one, that they might be confused about whether they're allowed to go to work if they're a non-essential employee. And so those are the sorts of things that they say they want to address in the special session next week. They're not entirely sure how they're going to do it yet, but they say they want to take some kind of action.
So the concern is inconsistency between counties. I didn't invite a columnist on this week, and maybe more's the pity. The stay-at-home orders and the penalties that they convey are meant as a kind of signal or a signal to the public with, you know, for how seriously we should take this. Aren't some counties, you know, more greatly impacted by COVID-19 than other counties, Bethany?
Oh, yes, definitely. In fact, many of the restrictions so far that have gone into effect are along the Wasatch Front. So we've got orders in Salt Lake County, Davis County, Weber County. But we also have a stay-home order in Summit County, which is has been extremely impacted by coronavirus infections and was one of the first places to really see hotspots because of the tourism activity there. So there are definitely areas across the state that have really been profoundly impacted in comparison to others.
Other counties, yeah, other places. I want to bring at some point Nate Carlisle in to talk about the Summit County where we did see a quick spread of the virus kind of early on, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But and that seems like a situation where, you know, geographically maybe you'd want to take a different action than what you would take at the state level. Is this about that, or is it about who gets the authority to actually declare a county's public health order? Do you know what I mean? Like, is it do we have details beyond sketch details? Is this about the wisdom of the health orders themselves or about who gets to declare them, Bethany? Do we know?
So the information we have about what they have in mind, what lawmakers have in mind, is coming from a lengthy list of potential action items that lawmakers are taking a look at or have compiled for consideration ahead of the special session. On this, it pitches the idea of repealing or limiting county and local health department shelter-in-place orders or their powers to issue a shelter-in-place order. But it also suggests that maybe they could sort of establish a kind of a model shelter-in-place order that then the local health departments could opt into or opt out of. And while the lawmakers that I spoke with this week weren't really sure what the final bill would look like, it sounded like they are kind of exploring that second option. They said that they want to kind of smooth things out between counties, establish some consistency in these health orders, rather than, eliminating the ability to put those orders in place entirely.
Before we move on to the special session and what might happen there, you know, what you've gleaned might happen there from this document that you reported on, what have the local jurisdictions that have declared public health orders, what do they say, stay-at-home orders, what do they say about the move to maybe undercut their power or override what they did?
So we reached out to a number of them. We only heard back a number of local governments. We only heard back from Salt Lake City's Mayor Aaron Mendenhall, who issued a stay-at-home order that was later superseded by Salt Lake County's stay-at-home order. But she said that she believes that city and county officials should retain the ability, retain the power to take care of public health and enact these kind of stay-home orders, especially in the absence of a statewide stay-home order, which they've asked Governor Gary Herbert to issue, and that he hasn't done so far.
I guess the devil will be in the details in terms of how they try to smooth out the difference between, those local health jurisdictions and the statewide orders. There is, as you reported, more in store for this special session and maybe more than one special session. How is this special session supposed to happen, Bethany Rogers? Is it by conference call? Is it in person? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, no, it's definitely not in person. So this will be the first time that Utah's legislature will be meeting in an all-electronic special session. This is a new ability that they granted themselves in the last legislative session, kind of anticipating that they would have to convene during the coronavirus and wanting to make sure that they were able to maintain social distancing and that everybody could work from home, essentially. So I spoke with House Speaker Brad Wilson about this yesterday. He said that he will be the only one who will be in the House chamber during the proceedings, but that he'll be looking at an array of gigantic monitors that'll have all of his colleagues' faces on them. So all 74 people will be on them. They'll be able to kind of, make a point of order or make a comment or vote in their normal way. It'll just be all remote.
Just before we, another question I have about this is: this is the first time that that we believe that the legislature is going to call itself into session. Why can the legislature do that? Normally, the governor has to do that. Go ahead, sorry. Yeah.
So that's a pretty new provision too. The legislature got the ability to call themselves into a special session in a time of emergency in 2018. It was on the ballot and voters approved giving them that right. They can only do it, like I said, in a time of emergency, and they have to, I believe, decide it by 2/3 of the legislature. But they do want to take this opportunity to exercise this new authority and to call themselves in.
What are the things they need to address during the special session? The budget is one of them, I know. Maybe some additional help monetarily for Utah residents who are impacted all of us who are impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. Can you talk about what they plan to do?
Yeah, the budget is definitely a really big part of the work that they have to do. They're expecting that that revenues will be way down because of the coronavirus and the economic impacts. One of the things they're going to do, I'm told, is to issue some kind of resolution or direction to county agencies, basically just telling them to tighten their belts and to start getting ready for some of the fallout and not to increase spending. They're not exactly sure how large they'll have to cut the budget, but they know that they will have to make some cuts. So that's one thing they're going to do. They're also going to be addressing some election-related items, trying to tweak elections so that people can do more things remotely and don't have to, you know, need getting rid of in-person voting largely.
Sure.
In the upcoming primary. They may also be doing some things around kind of creating a framework for how to reopen the economy and what that looks like, the path forward. So Speaker Wilson said there might be a bill on that, just kind of explaining how they'll phase back in certain businesses as the epidemic sort of subsides here in Utah.
Yeah, and time frame on that. Can you look into the crystal ball, Bethany, and tell us when that will subside here in Utah?
No, okay, good. I have no idea.
Proper answer. You know, this all brings me to another story that you reported on, which is a conference call on coronavirus that the Utah House of Representatives held in March. It was a kind of meeting, but it may have run afoul of Utah's open meetings laws. Can you tell us about that, Bethany?
So shortly after the legislature adjourned for their general session, there was a house-wide conference call on the coronavirus. It was apparently just sort of an update that that Speaker Wilson wanted to give to the full membership, just kind of telling them what had transpired since they'd adjourned. That he allowed lawmakers to submit questions, and then it was kind of like a Q&A. So they didn't vote. They did talk about what they might have to deal with as far as addressing their coronavirus. But despite that, you know, the experts that I spoke with said that, you know, with a quorum of lawmakers on the line, that still likely violated the state's open meetings act since they didn't notice it to the public and there was no way for the rest of us to listen in.
Will there be any repercussions for that? And then the question that I have that I think probably a lot of listeners have as well is how will the public participate in the upcoming special session, meaning committee meetings? You know, will they happen? Will I be able to testify before a committee or anything like that in the upcoming session? So two questions there. One is any repercussions for having violated the open meetings laws? And then secondarily, how do we all get involved in a meeting of the legislature that will be held remotely?
Yeah, there probably won't be any repercussions for the Open Meetings Act violation. I spoke with House Minority Leader Brian King, and he said it was an honest mistake, or it seemed to be an honest mistake that just in this new time of adjusting to remote meetings and communicating remotely that legislative leaders just didn't realize that this is an open meeting or should have been an open meeting. And so there's not really a good, way of imposing penalties or anything like that. The way that you deal with these things is through litigation. Apparently, like you could, sue over a decision made in a meeting that should have been open to the public, and then a judge might take that up and reverse the decision, for example. But because there were no decisions made and because by all appearances this was an honest mistake, there's not really a strong possibility that there's going to be any repercussions for this.
Sure.
On the other question about the special session, it's looking like they're actually not going to have committee meetings. They kind of decided that would be too complicated from a technical perspective. They will be accepting public feedback on their proposals, and it's hard for me to picture exactly what they have in mind, but what the House Speaker told me is that they will be publishing their bills a couple days in advance of the special session, and then they'll have some sort of way for people to write in their comments in the way that they would testify, and that those comments would be open to all of the members of the legislature to go and like review. It's not clear to me. He wasn't sure when I spoke with him whether, you know, a member of the public would be able to see the member of the public's testimony, another member of the public's testimony, or whether those comments would only be visible to members of the legislature. So some of that stuff, it sounds like they're still working out, but there will be an opportunity for people to give feedback.
I mean, there's also a difference between the comments being available for lawmakers to look at versus, you know, people being in front of them and them not being able to ignore, you know, plug their ears and not hear what the public is saying. I will, Bethany, just before we head to a break, because we do need to head to a break here in a second, anything else to add on the story of the upcoming legislature, participating or how the public can get involved? Sorry, sort of a rambling question, but any final thoughts on this story?
No, just that I understand that Utah is one of the first legislatures in the nation to try to gather in an electronic special session. So apparently we've been getting some attention nationwide for that, and it'll be interesting to see how it goes.
All right, reporter Bethany Rogers, thanks very much for bringing us this story. We are going to head to a break, and when we come back, we'll turn to other news from this past week. You're listening to Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Back in just a minute.
You're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. You can find podcasts of all of our local programs at kcpw.org. And hey, while you're there, why not make a pledge? Because your contributions power this local, independent, nonprofit outlet. Thanks for listening and for supporting public radio.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I am joined by Salt Lake Tribune reporters Bethany Rogers, Lee Davidson, and Nate Carlisle, all via the phone this morning. This is our Friday morning news roundup, and you can join with your questions and comments at 801-355-8255. You can also tweet to us. Our handle is at KCPW. A little earlier in the show, I broached the outbreak of the coronavirus that flared up in Summit County before it began to do so elsewhere. Though now where I am here in Salt Lake County, we have by far the most cases in Utah today. In any case, since I brought it up, Nate Carlisle, do you want to go into some of the reporting that you did on Summit County's coronavirus outbreak? It became a bigger problem there more quickly than anywhere else in the state. And you tackled this week the story of what you might call the epicenter of that outbreak, a bar on Park City's historic Main Street, a bar that has gotten a certain amount of blame from residents. Can you talk about the role of this bar in the Summit County outbreak, Nate?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, whether it's the epicenter, I think, is a point of contention. And the article points out that to the best the epidemiologist has been able to track it, travelers brought coronavirus to Summit County. What happened at the Spur was the first documented case of community spread. And a doorman there who had not traveled contracted coronavirus, and when the Spur found that out, they were faced with a decision of whether to stay open or whether to close briefly and clean or just what to do. And the owners did close the Spur Bar and Grill there on Main Street in Park City, which has a 500-person capacity. They closed immediately upon finding out the doorman tested positive. And then they made the decision to keep the establishment closed for the foreseeable future. Some other employees there have tested positive, or well, I should say have shown symptoms of coronavirus since then. I don't know if they were actually tested. Because the first community case originated at the Spur, some people have had a little hostility toward the Spur.
Right. And you had an interview with the owner of the bar, or one of the owners of this bar, and she kind of wanted to get her side of the story out I guess alleviate or try and let people know that they're not to blame, that, for example, travelers brought the bar to them from somewhere else. Residents up there have been kind of pointing to the Spur and saying, this is your fault?
Some of them, yes. I mean, Summit County is basically a small town that gets a lot of tourists. And, with any small town, you can find some people that are very opinionated on topic and others who have a more favorable attitude toward the Spur. I mean, there have been a few people that seem to want to blame the Spur, but I don't know how widespread that thought is. The bigger issue in Summit County is the per capita coronavirus count there. It's actually one of the hottest spots in the nation, or it was at least this time last week. Things have been leveling off some, for a county that has a population of, I think, only like 30 or 40,000 people, had a tremendous number of coronavirus cases there for a while.
Right. And they were, I mean, even comparing themselves to Italy or parts of New York City in that per capita count. You know, I don't know where to go with this, Nate. I mean, is there, the bar is closed, so is everything else. A lot of people were going to get coronavirus one way or another until we, you know, enacted the measures that we've enacted. What's left in this story? I mean, the Spur, in the end, is it responsible for an early spike in cases up there in Park City and its surroundings or not?
Well, I mean, that depends a little bit on one's perspective. The owners would tell you that, when the employee started showing signs of illness, he was sent home. And that shortly after that, and kind of independently of that, they started taking some steps to limit coronavirus exposure or potential exposure. You know, they only allowed about half capacity in the bar there for a while. They had hand sanitizer stations that you had to use before you could even come inside. They were telling other employees, you know, don't show up to work if you got symptoms. And remember, this is that, you know, second week of March when the United States was now cognizant of coronavirus, but we hadn't closed everything yet. You know, that week that Utah Jazz were still playing, that sort of deal. So they were taking, I'd say, about the same steps that a lot of other places were at that point. It was actually the, that same Thursday and Friday nights that, Rudy Gobert of the Utah Jazz tested positive. The NBA postponed its season. That the Spur got the news that the employee had tested positive, and they made the decision to close down and things like that.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
Like I say, that I mean, if you want to blame the Spur, okay. I can also see how any other bar in Park City could have had a doorman get sick the same way. Would the other bars have taken the same actions the Spurs did? I think that's a matter of discussion, too.
Sure. No, I mean, when you hit the point of community spread, it's very difficult to pinpoint any person to blame because there you are. That's how it's spreading. Nate, we're going to come back to you in just a minute to talk a little bit about our case counts and where some of those cases are, but I want to bring Lee Davidson in on this conversation and turn to other novel news from the world of novel coronavirus. Nate was talking about travelers arriving to Park City and maybe that being one of the ways in which coronavirus entered the state, which is kind of obvious. Travelers arriving to Utah by land or by air will be required now to report to the state of Utah certain details about themselves. This is because of the emergency that we're in, obviously. Tell us about the new rules for people crossing our borders, Lee Davidson.
Well, these rules kick in today, and if you drive across the Utah border, you will get an automatic text using kind of a high-tech system saying, when you stop driving, we need you to fill out a form. It'll ask you if you've been tested for COVID-19, and if you've traveled through recent hotspots, or if you're showing any symptoms. And once you file that at a website that you'll be given, you'll be given a response email saying we've received it. Depending on your response, people who are staying here as their final destination may be asked to quarantine, or they may have additional interviews from health officials. Also, if you're coming in the airport, you're handed a card essentially asking you to do the same thing.
Can I ask, when you mentioned that you cross a border, coming from a different state into Utah on a number of, I guess, sort of major thoroughfares, how do they know that I've crossed into the state and how do I get that text message?
It's a federal wireless emergency contact system. I don't know that I could explain to you how it works,
right.
But it does, apparently. And for anyone going over the border, they get this text.
Okay.
And you probably heard my phone give me a text just then, ironically.
Yeah.
So.
It's funny. I remember being an adult without a cell phone, but I guess maybe those days are long gone. You can assume that people, most people crossing into our borders will have cell phones. And then you also reported, Lee, that people arriving at the airport, you know, eventually would have their temperatures taken as well. How would that work?
Right. Well, like yesterday, I had to go to my doctor's office, and before they would let me in, they have a no-touch sensor. They point at my forehead that automatically takes my temperature. The state plans to do that at Salt Lake City International Airport eventually. They don't have enough sensors to have that order yet. But that's what they'll do. And I guess if you have a temperature, they are going to ask you to quarantine, self-quarantine.
And all of this obviously is to try and slow the spread of the virus or to prevent the spread of the virus. Other than the thermometers part, which I don't think is up and running right now at the airport, is all of the rest of this in effect? I mean, the forms that travelers need to fill out, the website, the text messages,
yes,
that's happening?
It started this morning.
Okay. Yeah. Hey, speaking of the Salt Lake City... go ahead, Lee.
I should mention that Utah's not the only state doing this. A dozen or so or more are doing it, and apparently more are being added every day. Hmm. Also... you know, people have asked, well, what happens if I don't, you know, fill out the form? Or, you know, police going to chase me down? And they said, no. This is just the right thing to do. And, gee, if we tell people what the right thing to do is, we think they'll do it. So we'll see.
Right. That's interesting, because if the repercussions for, you know, for reporting honestly that you feel slightly ill are that you have to self-quarantine for 14 days, you know, hopefully, right, hopefully people behave appropriately, but...
Hopefully you do that anyway.
Yeah,
yeah.
Exactly. Whether or not that's the case is another question. We were talking for a moment about the temperatures being taken at the airport, and Lee, I wanted to turn to another story that you reported on that front. Is anyone actually arriving at the Salt Lake City International Airport?
Well, not many. Earlier this week, the airport said that passengers there are down by 91%. And more kind of startling to me at the time, we get used to things over time, but they said it will take the airport probably 2 to 3 years to recover. Hmm. They are currently slashing their budget and trying to figure out how to make ends meet. Before COVID hit this year, Salt Lake City International was on track to set a new record for passengers going through. They thought about 27 million would pass through. Now, on a given day, there's about 1,900 passengers going through instead of 20,000 or 25,000.
Wow.
For the fiscal year that ends in June, instead of 27 million, they figure out that they'll have fewer than 21 million. They think that recovery is going to be very slow. For example, in June, they think they might get back up to maybe only a 75% reduction instead of 91%. Next year, the next fiscal year from July to June again, they're figuring that passengers will be down by 40%, and it'll be the lowest number flying for an entire year since 1993. And most major airports nationally are also predicting a 40 to 50% cut for the next year. So they're seeing things coming back slowly. Bill Wyatt, who's the executive director at the airport, gave his take on why that is. He directed an airport after the 9/11 attacks, and he said everything shut down for a few days, but then people started flying again. And he said the reason people got on airplanes was because of extraordinary security measures. So people felt safe. They felt like everyone who got on that plane had been checked out pretty thoroughly. He says you can't do that with COVID-19. You don't know about the person sitting next to you, and frankly, that person may not know if they have the flu or not. And he says it's creating a psychological condition that he thinks is going to take a long time to get through, unless you do things like take people's temperatures as they arrive at the airport.
Right.
Give a little bit of security.
Well, and then you have the sort of long-term prognosis of needing to see a vaccine released so that people can feel comfortable traveling again. I guess, did any of the people that you spoke with for this story, Lee, talk about, you know, the fact that airlines and airports and the travel sector in general might be facing longer-term pain than maybe other parts of the economy will? Was that something that they discussed?
Well, they were just talking, they weren't comparing it to other sectors of industry, but they see it being a long, slow recovery. Like this morning, The CDC stopped cruises, for example, for another 100 days. So cruises are not able to sail now until July, which also affects the air industry. You know, airlines take people to cruises, that sort of thing. So again, it's just a very slow recovery, they think. And in the case of Salt Lake International, they're expecting a 2 to 3 year recovery.
Wow. Yeah, it's just a really interesting moment in time, and we will see how long it takes for that recovery to happen. And of course, when the recovery actually begins, go ahead, Lee.
I would mention that the airport's in the middle of a $4.1 billion project,
right,
to essentially build a new airport adjacent to the current airport. It's supposed to open in September, and airlines themselves are paying the vast majority of the cost of this. And airlines are hurting right now, and the airport said their airlines asked them, you know, gee, should we throw the brakes on this? They all decided that it's too far along to do that, and they are going to continue and open as planned for at least the first phase out there.
Wow.
Later phases, they probably will slow down and look at what's going on.
Okay, so construction continues, and airlines continue to pay for that through at least September.
Right. Also, I should mention that the airport did give airlines a few breaks. They deferred their rental cost for April for, like, gates and other things they read out there. They also are not charging them to park planes overnight, which they normally would. Right now, airlines have parked a lot of their fleets, and so there's a lot of planes parked out there, but they don't have to pay for that.
Okay. All right. So some measures to try and help airlines a little bit by the airport. You know, I want to, before we head to a break, I actually want to bring Nate Carlisle back into this conversation. Lee Davidson, thank you so much for your reporting on this. And Nate, at the top of the show, I mentioned that the latest coronavirus case counts in Utah, you know, it's possible that we'll surpass 2,000 cases here in Utah today. Nate, you reported that some of those cases are in nursing homes around the state. And nursing homes are, of course, home to a population that is very vulnerable to this virus. What are the numbers here, Nate? How many Utah nursing homes have seen coronavirus cases?
Well, not just nursing homes, but multiple kinds of long-term care facilities, you know, hospice, homes for the people's developmental disabilities, that sort of thing. And the state has been in contact with 80 of these kinds of facilities in the last few weeks, and 44 reported having one staffer or one resident test positive for coronavirus. And this is a big deal because we've seen in other states just horror stories when a coronavirus gets into particularly a nursing home.
And that's one case. One case does not represent an outbreak, according to a spokesperson for the Utah Department of Health. Can you talk about that aspect of this story, Nate?
Well, the state defines outbreak as two such cases at one of these facilities. The state's only reported three such outbreaks, the most serious of which sounds like it's at here in Salt Lake City, at a place called Pine Creek Rehabilitation and Nursing over on, I think it's about 700 West and about 600 South in Salt Lake City. And they had so many positive tests there of staff and residents that they decided to turn that into a COVID-19 facility. They did remove residents who had tested negative, but everyone else stayed, and now they're just going to treat COVID-19 patients at that 34-bed nursing home.
Wow. In terms of the measures, so that's one of the measures is obviously converting into that kind of a facility. But when a nursing home has a patient who has tested positive, I guess they take all of the same steps that would be taken elsewhere, isolating that person. How does that work?
Well, to the best of their ability, yes, they will try to isolate the patient. But that's one of the issues at these nursing homes. How do you isolate a sick person from other sick people in a relatively confined space? You have a limited number of staff. The staff have to go back and forth, and the staff can get infected and spread it to other residents. And it can just be a very difficult thing to contain at these nursing homes and similar facilities.
Hmm. And so, remind us one more time, how many nursing home or long-term care facilities have seen cases of coronavirus? And then can you maybe compare that to the how many there are in the state?
Well, we know 44 have reported at least one case of coronavirus, and there's 356 such facilities in the state, according to the Utah Department of Health. And so what we really just have here is a sample, but it's a pretty significant sample.
Okay. Nate, anything to add to the story before we head to our second break of the show?
Well, I mean, the state is trying to help these facilities, first of all, keep coronavirus out, but also, you know, anybody that has a loved one in one of these facilities needs to have a contingency plan, whether that's move them to another facility or bring them home or something. But everyone who has a loved one in such a facility should be in contact with the facility. If specific staff are there, and of course their loved one, if they're able to communicate what's going on, and then have a plan ready.
Got it. Nate Carlisle, reporter with Salt Lake Tribune, thank you as well for your reporting on this story. We are going to head to our next break in the show and back in a minute for more of our Friday morning news roundup with reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune and our underplayed stories of the week. This is Behind the Headlines on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. Stay with us.
And again, you're listening to Behind the Headlines from KCPW, Salt Lake Public Radio, and the Salt Lake Tribune. Behind the Headlines is just one of our locally produced shows made to inform, engage, and entertain. Go check out our other podcasts and make a pledge at kcpw.org.
Welcome back to Behind the Headlines. I'm Roger McDonough, and I'm joined by the Salt Lake Tribune's Bethany Rogers, Lee Davidson, and Nate Carlisle. It's our Friday morning news roundup heard on KCPW and Utah Public Radio. You can weigh in on what you've been hearing by calling 801-355-8255. Or again, you can tweet to us at KCPW is the station's Twitter handle. And actually, on that front, I just want to mention something before we carry on. Someone on Twitter asked us a question that doesn't exactly have to do with the topics we've been tackling. It has to do with the stimulus that Congress passed. Part of that was a payment to most adults in the United States, $1,200. And on Twitter, Kate J. wrote, I have a younger friend in the Salt Lake area who's concerned that if she receives the $1,200 payout from the government, she'll be required to pay that back at some point. Can you address that perhaps on Behind the Headlines? And I'll just tackle this before we move on. The answer is that the $1,200 check is a payment, part of a stimulus, not a loan. It's yours to keep and is not meant to be repaid. We did do a show here on the station about forgivable payroll loans. Those are loans to businesses to pay their employees, and those will essentially turn into grants if you use them to pay your employees and for other qualifying costs. But that's something altogether different. The $1,200 is just money coming your way from the federal government to try and shore us up, and whether or not it's enough is an entirely different question. I hope that that answers your question or your friend's question, Kate J. on Twitter. With that detour out of the way, let's turn now to, I'm going to kind of spin the roulette wheel here to see what story we turn to next. And Bethany Rogers, we're going to come to you with malaria drug trials. Medical researchers in Utah are investigating whether malaria drugs might be used to treat patients with COVID-19. What's this study all about?
Yeah, the study is actually two different studies that Intermountain Healthcare and University of Utah Health have launched. It'll probably involve about 2,300 different coronavirus patients, and they will be testing the effectiveness of this malaria medication, hydroxychloroquine, and seeing whether it is in fact helpful in cases of COVID-19. This is the medicine that's been widely talked about on a national level because it's come up in a lot of President Trump's press conferences as a possible remedy in coronavirus cases, and it is something that a lot of conservative television personalities, people on Fox News, have been mentioning a lot.
There's this quote from one of the directors of one of the two studies that you mentioned here in Utah, Dr. Samuel Brown from Intermountain. He said, the likelihood is that hydroxychloroquine does not have an effect on coronavirus. We hope it might have a moderate effect, but that's not at all clear. I mean, I could say the same thing about Tabasco sauce or, you know, ketchup. The likelihood is that ketchup doesn't have an effect on coronavirus. So why are researchers conducting a study on something that they don't suspect will be impactful? Maybe that's the wrong question to ask. But does that make sense, Bethany?
Yeah, I think there's a few different reasons. One, as I said, it's because it's become something that has gotten a lot of attention recently, and people are looking for something. I mean, there's no approved treatment for coronavirus right now, so people want to explore all possible avenues. And hospitals are already using this medication for really severe cases under medical supervision. He's not at all confident that this will be some kind of wonder drug, but even if it has some kind of effect, it's worth exploring, according to these researchers. So they're going to be testing it not only in cases of hospitalized patients, but they have studies also looking at outpatients, people who are sick but they're able to manage their symptoms from home, and seeing whether the medication helps both of those groups recover and helps prevent the transmission of the virus.
I mean, I'm just coming back to that quote again because, you know, I acknowledge that science isn't about predicting outcomes, but you do generally start with some sort of hypothesis. And if you have an inkling that this drug is not going to be effective, I mean, I guess maybe the question to ask is whether researchers explained what drove them to conduct this study. Was it just the amount of sort of talking that's going on out there in the ether, especially given that sort of not so helpful or hopeful, I guess, statement from this researcher who's involved in the study? Was there any sort of explanation of where they decided to dig into this or why they decided to do this particular drug study?
There have been smaller studies done on this drug. The results have been conflicting, and there have been questions about, you know, the quality of some of the methodology in the studies. The evidence that's available is really unclear, as the researcher said, but there has been some suggestion that it might have, the drug might have an effect for some coronavirus patients, maybe a moderate, a very small impact, but still possibly an impact. So I think that the goal here is to do a really solid study and answer some of these lingering questions that a lot of people are asking in the absence of really good scientific data.
Are there risks to taking this drug? I mean, could you take it to treat or try to treat COVID-19 and actually do yourself, you know, no good whatsoever, but some harm instead?
Yeah, and that's, I think, another reason that the researchers want to figure out if there's any benefit, because, President Trump has even said about this medication, what's the harm? We don't have any really good treatment for coronavirus, so why don't we just try it out? The drug is something that's been around for a long time, and scientists do know a lot about it. So in that sense, they're comfortable with hydroxychloroquine, but it does come with an array of side effects, potential side effects. In rare cases, it can even cause heart arrhythmia that could be potentially fatal. Those aren't extremely high risk. It's not an extremely high risk drug, but since it is attached to some of those sort of potential side effects, they say it's really not worth just taking it if we don't know that it does any good.
The last question I want to ask on this is whether these studies that are looking at whether or not this is, you know, these malaria drugs are helpful for treating patients with COVID-19. When we talk about treating patients with coronavirus, we're not talking about a sort of vaccine that eliminates the virus from you. It's about alleviating symptoms so that you can recover, sort of. Is that what they're studying here? It's not about vaccination or anything like that, correct?
No, it's not about preventing people from getting the illness. It's about once people have the illness, the hope that the drug will help ease their symptoms and maybe help them recover more quickly. One of the studies is about transmission between people inside of a house. So they're studying viral shedding, or how quickly people, recover, I guess, from the illness, how quickly the virus clears from their body, and hoping to see if the drug has any effect on those, the rate of kind of getting rid of the illness, and whether it impacts, other members of the household getting sick as well. It's not a prophylactic. It's not something that you take and it protects you in some way from getting sick.
Okay. Bethany, any pressing part of the story that we need to know before we move on to one final story and then our underplayed stories of the week?
Just that one of the things that the researchers cautioned about is, panic buying of this drug. It is something that patients with lupus and rheumatoid arthritis are already taking and already prescribed to take to treat their condition. So there's concern that if people view it as some kind of miracle drug in coronavirus cases, that it'll deplete the stock available to people who do depend on it to, right, to manage their existing conditions.
And is that and is that a risk right now, given the study, et cetera, or is it just sort of, if there is a run on it in the future?
Not here in Utah. As far as I know, the researchers said that they were really mindful of making sure that their studies didn't deplete the medication for other people, didn't take it away from, lupus sufferers or people with rheumatoid arthritis or anything like that. But in other parts of the country, yeah, there have been shortages in pharmacies and there is concern that some sort of overhyping of the drug here in Utah could lead to the same kind of a thing.
Okay, Bethany, thank you for your reporting on this as well and for all of the reporting that you've done on coronavirus, and the same goes for all of the reporters that I'm speaking to right now, Nate and Lee. I wanted to actually try and squeeze in one more story, but I think that in the interest of time, we're going to have to turn now to our final segment, the underplayed stories of the week. And Nate Carlisle, I might start with you. I was going to ask you about the state coroner, the state medical examiner, talking about how we can be confident that the number of deaths in Utah from coronavirus is an accurate number. If you want to, you can choose that or you can do something else, and we can come back to that another week.
Well, yeah, I'll touch on this real brief. The state medical examiner says they've set up some redundancies and some procedures to make sure every coronavirus death is counted, and that, that would include people who died directly from coronavirus and people who had an underlying issue that was exacerbated by coronavirus. I did find out this morning that there's possibly two cases on the Navajo Nation that have not been counted, perhaps for lack of investigation at this point. For now, the death toll stands at 13, and the medical examiner is confident of that.
And
the other underplayed story I'd like to add is, did you have a question?
Oh, I just wanted to ask if they're doing post-mortem testing after someone dies, if they're testing people to verify whether or not they died of coronavirus.
Yeah, the medical examiner says every body that comes into his office now is given a post-mortem coronavirus test.
Okay.
And that his death investigators, when they go to scenes, they're asking questions about whether the deceased had symptoms of coronavirus.
Okay.
So they can try to screen those cases as well.
What's your other pick for underplayed story, Nate?
Well, we've heard about testing. We need testing. They want to, we want people with symptoms to go get tested. But the testing seems to have flatlined. I should say the number of tests being administered, and in some cases, it's even declining. And we're below our capacity to test right now, meaning fewer people are getting tested than could be, and we're getting kind of mixed messages on this. The state health department says it only wants people with symptoms to go get tested, in part because they want to preserve our testing capacity, and it consumes personal protective equipment to go get these tests done. On the other hand, we're hearing people in elsewhere in private industry, let's get everyone tested, try to figure out where this virus is.
Okay. Interesting pick for underplayed story there from Nate Carlisle. Let's go to Bethany Rogers. Bethany, your pick for underplayed story of the week.
My pick is a story by my colleague Julie Jagg. It's about how animal shelters are getting creative with adoptions, and about how they're doing things like having Facebook Live adoption fairs in order to make sure that people can still get a dog if they want to. So I thought that was interesting.
The dog is the only thing that's keeping me sane through this whole process. So I recommend it to people. Lee Davidson, your pick for Underplayed Story.
Well, as we've all focused on coronavirus, kind of unnoticed is we're hitting the height of the political season. And political party conventions are happening this month. Tomorrow, the Salt Lake County Democratic Convention happens. It's going to be all virtual, and people will vote by having a party volunteer call them and ask them how they're voting. In 2 weeks, the state Democratic and GOP conventions happen. Republicans, also virtual, and they're going to vote using an electronic app. Democrats are talking about having drive-up voting. So it's a different time politically.
It is a different time. Well, politically and in every other way, it is definitely a different time. Lee Davidson, thanks for that pick for Underplayed Story of the Week. I'm going to do an earthquake story. Brian Maffley has been delving deep on fault lines and seismologists and all the rest. And yesterday he had a short but important read that you can find. You may be eligible for rehabilitation tax credits administered by the State Historic Preservation Office if you have had damage to historic buildings. And you can learn more about that and about everything else that we've been talking about at sltrib.com. Lee Davidson, Nate Carlisle, Bethany Rogers, three reporters from the Salt Lake Tribune who are keeping us updated. Thank you very much for joining me on the show today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Roger.
You're welcome. Behind the Headlines is a co-production of the Salt Lake Tribune and KCPW. Thanks very much to Operations Director Jesse Ellis here at KCPW and to the Utah Public Radio team in Logan for their assistance. I'm Roger McDonough. Join us again next week.